podcast. Killer Keller official.com.
Instagram UK frontline.
Beatbox created.
Killer Keller.
And we're here to talk about world music and street culture.
Killer Keller podcast.
Big shout out to our friends Graffiti Kings. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Killer Keller podcast, live and direct. Serves you fucking right, yeah. Audacity reigns in the Killer Keller Heights, where I had the nerve to invite some pretty heavy dons inside the ride to come around and have a chat and chop it up with me. And this is no exception. Like, subscribe and all that business. You are now going to be hearing the voice alongside myself with Justin Rollins, 706, author, graffiti writer, ex-graffiti writer, an all-round spokesperson for the new generation. How are you?
Yeah, good, man.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How's that for an intro?
Yeah. Nice.
Top five, top six?
Yeah, definitely.
How you been?
Yeah, I'm good, man.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What's been popping?
Man, just living life, man. Being positive, focusing on all the good stuff and just trying to make big things happen, man. Yeah.
Have you traveled far to get here?
Just travel from South London, Southwest London, so only like 40 minutes or something.
Yeah. For those of you that ain't familiar with, like, you know, the general geographics of London, there is, you know, some people are from out of town, some people are from out of country. Like, there's this the bridge of south to north is very real, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
But connectivity wise, it's like, gets easier once you get to know the train networks, isn't it?
Yeah.
That whole kind of Clapham Junction overground thing.
Yeah, that overground from Clapham's just easy, quick, easy to navigate.
Actually, what am I talking about? You as a man will know about trains more than anything.
Yeah.
The train networks.
The railway children, that's what we were called, man.
Yeah.
We lived, from like, say the ages of 11 till maybe 17, just spent my childhood in and around the London rail network.
Fuck.
Just, like a street kid. Well, not a street kid, like a railway kid, really. Yeah.
Was there a sense of freedom with that? Because that's quite a crazy notion, that the railway children, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Runaway children.
Yeah, well, I called one of my chapters in the book The Railway Children, and people always mention that. They say that's a sick name of a chapter. But that's what we were. It was freedom. You wouldn't be paying for your fare. You would just it would take you anywhere. And then obviously if you go onto the railway tracks, it was more freedom. It was peaceful compared to the hustle and bustle of the railway.
Mm.
Or say you've been out painting at night, you've missed last buses, last trains, so you're like, right, I'm gonna walk the railway back. It was a lot safer being a little kid
than walking the street
because
that's cool.
I always point this out, like, people don't realize, like, when you're a teenage graffiti tagger, writer, artist, you know, you could be 13, 14, 15. We started off really young, and you're out there on London streets, and it can be dangerous, man. Like, weird people are around when you're a child, man, like pedos, nutcases, just the wildlife and the scary side of London comes out at night. And then if you're a little guy just tagging along, man, anything could happen, man. So going onto the railway, you were safe, man.
You know, the first thing that comes to mind when you said that was, you know, in Star Trek when they'd beam them down to a place and it's fucking hectic.
Yeah.
And they've been beamed down for a purpose. They've got to kill the Martian or, you know, get the gold or whatever. You know, whatever fucking Star Trek does, I don't know. But it's that whole idea, like, shit's popping off and all of a sudden they push the button and they're back in the room. That reminded me of what you just said there about the trains versus the streets.
Yeah. Well, it was, man. Like, just being on the track and you know that you're safe. You often obviously hear the hissing of a train and you know to move a certain way or move to the side. But yeah, I remember I was in Wimbledon train depot. Like, I was probably about 14. I was trying to find somewhere.
Strong depot back then as well.
Yeah. I wasn't painting, didn't have any paint or anything. Me and my cousin, we were just basically sleeping in there. And we kept on going from one train to another. It's like, right, we find a little first class cabin. And the first class cabins back then, they had these little cushions with like pink silk covers on.
Yeah.
We were so cold. we ripped off the curtains. We had curtains as covers, and then we were like, our ears were cold, so we took off the silk pink cushion covers, put them on our head, keep our ears warm, right? But it was still cold, so we were like, right, let's try and move to another train. So we just kept the new pink silky hats on, and we pushed the blankets up our tops, so we obviously look like we're overweight. Climbed out of the train. Now we're back in the yard, and we're walking in between, well, we're about to walk in between two trains to get onto the other train. And we looked over, and there was trackies straight away. Oi! We just ran. My cousin ran in one direction. I was running the length of the train, but I was so small, I could sort of duck down and see the trackies' feet on the other side of the train chasing me. But the whole time, I had this pink hat on and big belly from the thing. Anyway, I got away. My cousin ended up getting taken to the office and getting a lift home by the police. Well, I should have took his option.
But, oh, bro, luxury.
Yeah. But I had to go back onto the street. And then I remember just seeing this like rowdy group of men, like they had a shopping trolley, and they were pushing their mates in the shopping trolley. Reared up. And then I was just scared. So I climbed back onto the tracks. And then that was the first time that I thought, right, like, I'm safe on these tracks.
How old were you that time?
I was probably about 14.
Wow.
Yeah, that would have been 98,
99.
Yeah.
It's mad that era, that time of your life. I remember getting mugged on a train, and, you know, these things stay with you because they're it's not like branded in your head as like a life lesson. Well, it is actually. It's like, well, I'm never fucking doing that again.
Yeah.
It's almost like it becomes a pattern, doesn't it?
I'd been mugged out on the railway. I found graffiti through travelling into London with my grandparents. I must have been about 11 years old.
Mm.
I was quite a disturbed and destructive kid. And my grandparents take me to Central to go to a museum or something, which I just had no interest in. And I was looking out of the window, and I saw like a abandoned, like battered, rusty old train carriage. Can't remember where it was. And it was just battered in like colourful signatures. And then 11 years old, I said to like my granddad, like, oh, what's that, granddad? What's that, like, excited? And he was like, that's criminal damage, vandalism, like graffiti. And then I was just like, it just hooked me. Like, I couldn't get it out of my mind. And then went to school, and I was in junior school. So I was like, 10, 11. And I remember stealing the teacher's whiteboard markers, not realizing that whiteboard washes off in the rain or by water. So I took that, and then it's crazy. I made up my own crew at like 10, 11 years old, and it was called MFP, and it stood for motherfucking prostitute. Random. And I was tagging up this white bridge, MFP, come back 2 days later, it was gone. And then realised I'm tagging with a whiteboard marker.
And I bet then it took a lot of balls to go do that. I was like, I'm doing.
Just to write on some bridge, man, like a proper, like, what you would class as like a toy, but you've got to start off somewhere, do you know what I'm saying? Right, and that's how graffiti basically got me. And then it just started developing.
Yeah.
And like where I just feel like what you put your heart into, you'll finally start attracting into your life. So,
Get the frog there for you. All the energies.
Yeah. So I started, I created a tag. Yeah. Like my first tag was Fess, and I was tagging,
FES.
Yeah. FES. Yeah. And I started like tagging the local alleyways, and it wasn't long before somehow I bumped into other kids that were tagging, and then they were a bit older, they're a bit wiser. And, they taught me you got to be like hitting your local train station, and started showing me bushwhacking and stuff, like bushwhack the train, the Victoria bound train, write Fess on the side of it, and then it would be taking your tag into London.
Is this intel? Like, what is bushwhacking?
Bushwhacking was like basically the bush part of it is you're hiding in a bush, train pulls up, you jump out the bush, bushwhack the train, spray your name on the train.
Gotcha.
Obviously, if the train's staying there for a little while, 5 minutes, you can get a quick dub or something on the side of it.
Yeah.
So you would hit the Victoria bound train, and it would pass through like a little kid, 11 year old kid from like Sutton area.
And then it would go straight into your nerve center.
Yeah, yeah, and it would, yeah, go Clapham, and then other people would start, and then that's how you start getting known.
Mm.
Well, at that age, obviously, till I started branching out and heading into, like, deeper into South London and Central London.
Just going back to what you were saying about your, you know, you made up a crew.
Mm.
Did you have aliases within that crew that you were defining as other characters, but you was all you? Or was it just you?
No, that was literally just me. You. It was just, that was just my first thing.
But and, I mean, with regards to the 706... Mm. I mean, I know we were coming on to that, but what's with the number thing?
The number thing was literally, it was about 98. Yeah. I'd got into Graph now. I started to learn, obviously, inks, paints, racking. Well, racking was more old school. We would call it raising.
Yeah.
Plots, going out into bumpkin territory, country area to steal your paint. Mm. I'd basically learnt the basics of graffiti. And at 98, there was... a crew around called WK, Who Cares, from the Kingston Borough.
Mm.
And I was hanging around with them at the time, and I was skipping school. I couldn't, like, focus in school at all. So we was in history, and we were talking about allies that England had in the World War Zone.
Mm.
Allies, and I thought, allies, that's an all right tag. So I was spelling it A-L-I-E-Z, allies, or A-L-Y-Z. So then that was my tag. But these WK guys I was rolling with, they had a little phase of throwing up numbers next to their name. So I remember there was like Depth 40, I can't remember Prince number, maybe 288.
There's still people that do
Yeah. So they had numbers. Quite a lot of them were just like, you could go to Rains Park Station, New Malden, Wimbledon, and there was loads of numbers. Wads 33.
Mm.
So I was like, right, I need a number. But I was looking at all their numbers. Their numbers were low. So I just randomly choose 706.
But without then, another name, it was just that.
And then I thought, do you know what? This stands out. So there's like Print, Learn, Yonder, Vids, and then a 706 dub. So,
bro, that was my kind of era, bro. Yeah. Like, I think you guys represented like my generation of like, you know, I remember seeing Vids. He was really fucking tight on the big dubs, you know? And Learn, obviously, Learn got a real style about it. He kind of blocked out his style a lot more.
Learn smashed it. He is the best right watch, I say, the best writer from over that side where he's from.
Yeah.
So I dropped the allies. I become 706. And then one day, like 98 was big, like South London graph. You had like Croydon, Kingston, Sutton, that part, Wandsworth, and everyone was sort of linking up around Clapham. I think before that 98 generation was 97 Wimbledon, that was like Char, I think Pies and that, and a lot of hardcore writers, Neat, and that was there in that era. And then we was just about a year after. So Char and that was still hanging around then, but they were sort of growing up and getting into other things. But then there was, so there was like the Kingston side. That 98, man, it was just... You were sitting at Clapham Junction, or you were wandering around Clapham Junction back and forth, and you would see other kids, and you'd be like, you'd look at their fingers, look at their, if they've got a bag, and you'll know straight away if they're right. You write, what's your tag? You know each other, and you're like, well, you could roll with that person for like 2-3 days, staying at their house, staying at a yard. You could lose each other in a yard, or lose each other on track and never see them again. Do you know what I mean? Ever see them again. Do you know what I'm saying?
How transient's that?
Just crazy. That's just how it was, man. Clapham Junction was the one back then, 98.
Yeah, there used to be like I remember coming in from East Croydon, Clapham Junction. I'd always have my neck swanned to the left because there was that kind of disused train that was just on, just as you get in from that side where the tunnel bridges, and you kind of, I always did a left, and there'd always be like some awesome pieces on this one particular train.
Whereabouts did you say?
Clapham Junction.
Clapham Junction.
Clapham Junction. You know where the bridge is as you go through. Just on that left hand side, you kind of rubberneck yourself around to the left a bit, and there'd always be something.
Vaguely remember. Vaguely remember.
Back in the day, long time ago. Yeah. So that was kind of like was there a lot of benching around that the Clapham Junction way?
Yeah, I wouldn't say like there was a specific bench that people would sit. Would sit on and you'd go there, but you would That's where you would find other writers, or you could arrange to meet a writer there, and where you know who's been hitting that sort of area, you're seeing their tags.
Mm.
So you arrange to meet a writer there. But remember, back then it was just like, yeah, meet you there at 2. Didn't have phones. Yeah. So you could go there to platform 16 at the end, 2 o'clock, and then you get there 2:30, and their tags there, but they're not there. Mm. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's like that's just how it was, man.
Damn.
That was
stood up.
Yeah, yeah. So that was 98,
mm-hmm.
and then 99, I was being bullied by a WK.
Did the same people? Yeah. That, really?
Yeah, yeah. WK. They stood for Who Cares. They were from Kingston. Like Cambridge Estate area, Norbiton, New Malden.
So where did that kind of I mean, you don't have to go too deep in it, but like, what? Like, I thought you was tight, and then
yeah, it was just like I'm mixed white and Asian. I grew up not knowing who I was, just trying to fit in. Graffiti right. gave me an identity for once in my life, but I was had that more innocent side to me. Did have a bit of a wild, crazy side.
Mm.
I had a few like violent incidents in my early childhood, but I was quite a scared kid. Like if my cousin letters, if he was trying to like play fight me and dig me, I'd be like the weak one. But then I don't know what happened. Something just switched down the line. But yeah, so WK was bullying me.
Mm.
I moved. Well, I was living in Malden area then. The first stop on the Northern Line. And I thought, I can't go over that area. My cousin Letters lives over there. And I always was like scared to go over that way in case WK caught me. And then I was just at a local station, like Malden area, well, St. Hillier Station. And I see a guy looking at his, see the paint stains and stuff. And then I said, you right? He was like, yeah. It's like, he writ Spy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Not the proper Spyer. He was just like this guy, Joe, who became Baff,
yeah.
my best friend, Baffler, but he wrote Spy at the time, and then he soon switched it to Baff. So I started writing with him, and we're like, then I'm growing, I'm thinking like, I'm hearing that the best places to write or you gain most respect is the underground, and we've got an underground station right there, so we can just shoot off into London.
Yeah.
Hit the Northern Line, hit Malden Tube Depot. So Baff was teaching me those things. And then he had a couple of friends from school. One wrote Nemzar, the other one wrote Chez. They were from Mitcham.
Mm-hmm.
So then there was four of us. And then we were like, right, let's start a graffiti crew. So we would listen to Bone Thugs and Harmony. And one of their songs was called Wasteland Warriors.
Mm.
So we... created WLZ Wasteland and then a Z for the end of Warriors. But after a couple, we were spraying it up WLZ, and then after a couple of weeks we changed it to WZ, and then my cousin come over, a few other guys joined, so it's maybe about six of us spraying WZ around Sutton Borough.
I get you coming now.
Yeah. And then it started getting lined out by WK. But we weren't thinking this sounds too similar. We're just kids. We ain't thinking that deep ahead.
Subconsciously, yeah. There's an influence of like the people's surroundings, I guess.
Yeah. So then you had like, if you had a map of that part of South London, you would have like Malden, Mitcham, Tooting, Sutton, like Wallet and Carshall, and that was like WZ territory. Mm-hmm. And then you had like WK were like... Kingston, Norbiton, New Malden, Worcester Park.
Right.
They went out a bit further. But then like the boundary was like Cheam, Wimbledon and Raines Park. So there was some kids from that area. They was in either crew or they would cross both crews.
Wow.
And yeah, that's where that became like an area where you could clash. So someone was sending messages over saying like, tell Sevens you better stop, or Seven, I wasn't Sevens then, tell 706 to stop writing WZ, they're lining out. But where I was with my friends now,
yeah.
and I felt confident, and I didn't like WK because of the bullying stuff, it was like, I can't exactly tell my friends, right, sorry, but we got to stop writing WZ. Then we're lining back, and it was just fun. It was just tit for tat fun. But then obviously it turned darker, and then violence started happening between both crews. Whoa.
Yeah, and this kind of opens, I mean, we'll call it a chapter, because this is where really it gets into like a more violent affiliated kind of mindset, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, we started marking off our territory, like WZW, like, I don't think that had been done before in sort of London graffiti slash gang. Like you're actually marking off your territory. No, this is our territory. And there would be buses like battered, like a bus that say went from Sutton to Kingston, the 213. It would have layers of WZ and WK graffiti with messages and lines going through.
But I kind of remember that. Remember that.
Yeah, and we thought it was a good idea that the bus, the 213, it goes straight through their area. And remember, we're street kids, we're on the street, so cool. Getting onto 213 buses and doing a massive back to front WZ on the front windows. So when they're in the street,
see this thing, New Malden,
Cambridge, looking up and it just says WZ coming through their area. Yeah. And then they start sending it back. It's funny when you look back on it.
Oh yeah, I mean a lot of commercial brands could do do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Taunting the public.
So I was saying before that a few kids were on the border and they were either friends with WZ or friends with WK. So we knew a guy. He was on the border. He went to school in their area. And he was saying like where they hung around. And there was another crew. It was more like a street crew. They were called Shadow Crew. And they were from like Round Shore Estate in between Sutton and Croydon. And they had a fight with WK at a party in Cheam.
Damn, this is some gang shit.
Yeah. And then we were friends with them. And they had come down to Malden to hang around with us. Like WZ. So SK sort of was abolished and they became WZ. So now like the members are growing. And they had this beef with WK. But I remember being I was probably 14 and like SK were a bit more rowdy. Like a couple of them or a couple of their older brothers, cousins would use knives and stuff like that. And I was out of my league then. Right. But then I was taking like, no, this WZ's my gang. Like to think of it, just a little boy shouting his mouth off. So I'm trying to impress these guys. And this is where it's literally that whole peer pressure thing is real.
It was like a light switch.
So it's like, so then this kid comes along and says, oh yeah, WK, they're bullying me. Like go school in the area. He knows where they are. He knows where they hang around. And then I'm shouting my mouth off saying what I'm going to, let's go there Friday. Going to do this. Like to think of it now, so if I'm a man and I'm looking at a 14-year-old little boy saying this stuff, I don't know what I'd think, but it's just weird, right? Yeah. It's strange.
It's like a double U. It's like looking at it in retrospect.
Yeah. It's a strange thing, right?
The ghost of
Come Friday, I'm in Malden and I'm around the back of the station, and SK turn up, and then all these other kids will start turning up, and then it's like, oh my God, this is real now. I have to go. And then there was a crazy kid from our area. WZ was growing and we was attracting all the crazy lost sort of kids from the area. And there was a guy, Crazy Steve, we'll call him. And his dad had made him a weapon for the fight, right? Like his dad helped him.
What?
It's a completely different world. Oh, so the dad helped him make, it was half a broomstick which had been sharpened into a spike with screws out of the other side and a Stanley knife blade coming out above the screws.
Stop that.
And then that was it. Like what? That Friday afternoon he was there. All these people come and it was like I literally got picked up and just sucked away into something that we basically went down to the area, went down to the alley where they were, and there's probably three or four of them there, and I was told like to set it Sevens. My name was Sevens then. A graffer from Croydon area, Avon, started calling me Sevens
the whole time.
I became Sevens. And and then there was like, set it, Seven, set it, because I'd been shouting my mouth off the whole time. I didn't think I could, I could have easily slipped to the back and just watched what they're doing and think, fuck, I need to get out of here. But I had to hit one of them with a piece of concrete and round the head, and I was cool with this guy. I'm not going to name his name on here because what I'd done, obviously, if I could go back, I wouldn't do it. But yeah, I had to hit him with a piece of concrete. My friend Crazy Steve pulled out the weapon with and he was hitting someone around the head with a broomstick with the screws. And then I think somebody got stabbed. And everyone just ran in different directions.
Wow.
And then we got back to Malden and everyone was coming from like different buses. Some people had made their escape to Wimbledon, come down to Malden, or buses up to Cheam and down. And then everyone was like really hyped and adrenaline pumping and stuff. And then I literally just didn't really think anything of it. Like it was, it made me feel like good that all of a sudden I was with a gang.
Yeah, your team came.
I was with a gang. But then it came to me as like he arranged it. Like he's the person to look to. So all of a sudden I got this responsibility from these other kids and stuff. Like he's the one to look to lead us basically. So I went from that skinny little child being bullied and teased, and I was quite like innocent into that lifestyle.
To a place of authority almost.
And then WZ, those violent attacks started going on with.
Stop there.
Not just with WK, but with other gangs and stuff. Because like I've said before, that when you're doing graffiti, you are. You're not like a normal gang. You're traveling around, so there could be say a street gang in Tooting, they call themselves Tooting Boys or something, for example, and you're a graph crew. You're graphing and you're stealing and you're in that area, and then they're like, what are you doing in there? And then you'll find them. So you could come into contact with different sort of street gangs all around the city because as a grapher you're traveling around writing your name. So. Yeah, that's where WZ became, and then we started calling it Warzone, because that's what we was creating.
Wow! But so then fulfilling almost like now this is really what it's become.
Yeah, yeah.
Did it ever override the graph activity, or was it one and the same?
No, it definitely overrid it.
Really?
The graph that summer, I think, was when WZ started becoming really known, and we had quite a lot of writers would come down and chill with us. So, like, round the back of Malden would become, like, a writer's bench, really, because you had everyone coming down. Croydon writers, all sorts of writers, from all over that, around south.
Mm-hmm.
Like, about one of my old friends, he had come down Wandsworth Way. Bimbo was with about.
This is crazy, by the way.
Yeah, like, Zonk, Mood.
Yeah.
Cooper, Leek.
Rest in peace, Mood as well.
Loads of writers would come down. And yeah, would chill with us. Gusto come down.
Gus.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like your stripes that was earned, you know, the danger aspect of like association, and although like you're saying, it outweighed the activity of the graph, it heightened the credibility of the graph.
But the graffiti, if I come to think of it, none of WZ came from like wealthy homes or like we weren't like, you know, we wanted things like you hear that it's like stereotypical. Oh, we want like I'm poor. I want a nice pair of trains. All this rubbish. Yeah, but we was taught by older graffiti writers, some DDS writers. How to steal, and how to steal trainers and how to steal clothes. So when that graffiti turning into sort of a gang mentality, we took that graffiti thieving side with us and then became sort of a street sort of robbing gang with a graffiti side to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we also took that rowdy mentality into, we wasn't ever a graffiti crew that went and toured London going in different yards. It was like Malden, this is our area. Malden yards there, we can go in there when we want, we can chill in there, smoke in there, do what we want in there,
and not feel threatened or anything like
Mm. and paint the Northerns, and they were the old Northerns. I think they were like 1959 stock. The
grey looking
gray
business,
like, they were the classics, and then people like Char taught me barbecue blacks. I think it was Plasticoat barbecue black. He said, use that on your Northerns. Yeah, so using it. And 3-4 days later, the dirtiest stains, man. And that's when...
Wow.
Yeah, and then I can't remember who was really up the north end. I don't know, there was like Alien, Gobbs. I don't know, Alien, Gobbs. I don't know if not Alien was Gobbs. I can't remember. Alien, who else was there? I think Necker maybe was painting.
Necker.
Was it Enzo?
Yeah, Enzo.
He was the king of the scratches.
Yeah.
Scratch, I think. Cold. Chuck 101.
Yeah.
Voms. He used to write Vomit as well.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Like Mepha. That was like
Mepha,
that was a guy I looked up to. Yeah. He was from Sutton.
He was a Mepha, big FDC. G back then as well.
Yeah, he was sick, man. Char. But Chuck was the one for me. Chuck 101. Mm. I remember... like climbing through Malden shed and going deep into the shed, and it was just like who could go the deepest into the shed, and then going around the corner and there was just like this tube sitting on its own with Chuck's rat throw up just staring at me, and it was just stuck in my head, and it was like, oh my god, this is where I want to be. Do you know what I mean? So we didn't like travel smashing every yard, but like Malden was our yard, and that's how we loved it, man. We was living that life. Like probably when we looked at like subway art and books like that, and you saw the old the subway trains battered in the Bronx and Harlem stuff, that's what I thought I was doing in my mind, like seeing the dirty old London Underground. It was like that was it for me. It obviously it's something different for someone else, but for me, the graph years probably 14 to 16, maybe those 2 years when it was like painting Malden Yard and hitting a lot of BR yards. That was it, man. That's what I was living in my head, or living what I'd seen in some music videos, or the film The Warriors, when I had to spray a W to let everybody know they had been there. That was all in my mind.
Yeah, it's culture.
Yeah,
the whole influence of that culture at the time. So did art play like a big part in your... Because, you know, some people are just straight vandal. Other people like have a little bit more of a kind of creative flair.
Yeah, I loved both sides of it. Like we were horrible vandals.
Yeah.
You know, like we was taught to steal tool sharpeners or dart sharpeners to scratch windows. But then you could also use a piece of brick. So you know, getting on as a bus, like grab a stone, grab a piece of brick to carve your name.
There was a real warrant out for people with the scratching thing at one stage, didn't there?
That was Enzo from North London. He had nearly Enzo scratch on every carriage on the Northern Line.
They go across the whole window as if it was
But then it was mentioned in his case that it was could have been like an OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And then when my friends would get a tag, Bath, Letters, Vids, they'd get a tag or two tags. I had to write 706 like 10 times. Like, so it was like an OCD for me as well.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I get you. Yeah.
And then I think a lot of taggers and writers. Also, I see people that come out of retirement and you start seeing, I ain't seen that tag for like 15, 20 years. And then in my mind, it was like, I was going through like a dark time, say a couple of years ago, like having a bit of a mental breakdown because of things that happened in my life.
Post-traumatic.
Yeah, post-traumatic sort of stuff. And I was trying anything to, like, keep my mind straight and not think about what was going on in my head. And then, like, anything, like walking the dog, going to nice, like, country walks, like, listening to nice music, reading books on, like, self-help, like, nothing was helping me. And then I just got pen and paper, started doing a little outline. I hadn't graphed for years. Then got some paint, and then I'd say like I'd done a piece and it took me 2-3 hours. It was like, oh my God, I haven't thought. I've gave my brain some time to chill and relax. And then I look at what was going on in my early childhood when I first started graphing and I was going through certain things. It was like, oh my God, I was reaching for a sort of art therapy then.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? So going back a couple of years, I started painting.
That's crazy, by the way.
Yeah, thanks, man.
I mean, I think there's an argument for that in music. I remember I went through a depression.
Yeah.
I didn't want to touch beatboxing. I don't want nothing, do none of it. And now, I don't know, I wouldn't be here without it.
It's mad because I'll come back into graph probably a couple of years ago. I'm only like painting legals and like, you know, derelict buildings, like what people give a shit about. It's obviously not the same buzz as climbing into a yard and stuff, but for me it's therapy. It's like piece and I'm creating something out of nothing, basically. Mm. Yeah.
Do you ever get like, because we talk about the post-traumatic side of it, I mean, there's obviously like a lot that went on. I mean, by the way, the book, yeah. The Lost Boys, like this needs to be, I mean, it's going to be a movie as well, yeah. Isn't it? Like if you guys haven't checked it out or you don't know anything about it, there's loads of information on YouTube, obviously here, but there's the book itself, you know. It's available. It's available.
Yeah, yeah. It's available on Amazon or on, you can get a dubbed personalized copy from me on my Instagram, which is Southbound Bullies.
There you go.
Or from my publisher, Waterside Press.
Mm.
But yeah, about the post-traumatic stress thing.
Yeah.
When I was around 5 years old, my mum was sending me to a childminder's house and I was just a normal boy.
Mm.
And then one day the childminder's son was looking after me. He must have been about 14. And he got some fishing wire, started like strangling me.
Stop.
And I remember just being in fear, like fear. And then like, I remember like I had a checkered shirt on or something and it was like wet with sweat and fear.
Wow.
And then he let go and then I, catching my breath. I was five and then...
Fishing wire?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, and then, fuck.
And then he got a boy with disabilities, learning difficulties, started strangling him. And he wasn't crying, but I was crying. And then afterwards, they were like he's a spastic, and yeah, and he's not crying. Look at you like that, right? And then that was always in my mind. And then I told my mum. My mum sent me back there, right?
Hmm.
For whatever reasons. But that fear of that guy, the childminder's son, is stuck with me throughout my life,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So that was the age I started stealing stuff from school, like stealing toys. But I'd always give them to other people. I'd never keep them for myself. And I struck out with a kid with a pair of scissors in art class. Just whacked a kid with them in the face. And then just, like, obviously they're not the sharpest scissors, but I cut his lip a bit. And I remember being sat down by the teachers and like interrogated, but I just didn't say anything. And then I would be like smashing my toy cars, doing like throwing stones into a crowd, the kids park and playing in a park. And that was like my destructive behavior.
Stemming from this?
Yeah, stemming from that, I believe. And then setting fires. And then when I saw that train carriage with my nan or my granddad, and I saw that real destructive side, that's like, this is good. Like, and that's when graffiti got me. But I always had that fear of bullies. And then I can see bullies throughout, like early childhood, and then the WK thing, and then in Graff as well. Like there was older boys in Graff that it was the culture.
Yeah.
You could have been raising paint all day, and then you walk around the corner and there's some DDS guys, some South DDS guys, and then some were cool, some weren't, and they just rob you for your paint. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then
so you've just got to re-up and just come hard, and you're forced to be in that.
Yeah. And it was literally like you're a kid out on a railway and you're enjoying like graffing, and then it's literally like, just imagine someone punching you in your face and one day it changes and it's like, the graph area where I'm from, it's not really like that. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying? It can be like you walk around that corner and obviously you're out there. You could be going into like a Halfords in Red Hill, and then this group of older graffers like are coming walking out and they're like, oh my God, it's Sevens. And then try like take you or rob you or beat you.
Right, so okay. I'm going to ask a question now that maybe other people are thinking. Was it, in retrospect, you know, for all your kind of therapy and all the things that you've gone through, was it the bullying that that became a magnet to you, or was it the violence? You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying that you encouraged it, but you became used to it.
Yeah.
On both sides. Which one was the stronger, do you think?
I think the bullying, I think I was attracting the bullying, because once I made that switch in my mind with the whole WK thing and acting out violent, that people still did bully me. There did come a point when I went through something really dark that I was like, no one's ever bullying me again. I don't care who you are, big, small, whatever, I'm going to seriously hurt you. Not a nice frame of mind to be in, because you're always angry and you're always drained.
I bet.
But yeah, so it was all, for me, it was all law of attraction. What you put out you get back. So I was quite vulnerable, got bullied, start becoming really violent, more violence came. Yeah. It's like for example, road rage. If you're an angry driver, you will meet another angry driver. It don't matter 100%. Who you are, what walk of life you're from. Yeah, you're just gonna meet them.
And also, I'd also argue in other deficiencies, like an eating disorder.
Yeah,
you want more food, but you know deep down, you know, the desire for that. In a similar respect to the bullying, it's like the more you feed yourself, the worse it gets, but you know it's the thing that you kind of, you're subconsciously like bringing into your life.
Yes, it's weird because obviously I didn't like it, and that's when I fought back and became this character Sevens. Mm. But then there was even people in my own gang I had to be wary of because I wasn't the strongest like physically, so I'd have to be the more violent or always do something more crazier because it sent out a message, don't mess with me. But everything was based on fear, basically.
Fear's a powerful thing, man.
Yeah.
And for real.
Yeah, so like WZ, it spiraled out of control. It became really violent, really dark, and graffiti just got washed away. And then my friend Baff died suddenly.
What year was this?
That was 2001.
So a little way down the road from the late 90s.
Yeah, and then I basically wanted to end it. So I got onto a train, I committed a robbery. I knew I was going to be on CCTV, didn't care, went to prison for years. And then whilst I was in prison, I was in Aylesbury Prison, HMYOY Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire. That housed 18 to 21-year-olds serving 4 years to life. So any of them hardcore cases, murder cases, disturbing cases you saw, and they was in the age group, most likely be in that prison,
like
4 years to life. And I was serving 4.5 years for robbery. So I'm 4.5 years robber.
Seems a lot.
With like killers, like real sadistic, like dangerous young men with nothing to lose.
Wow.
And then I was on a prison unit, and this guy comes on a unit. He had obviously been in a prison for a while, and people were joking with him, and then he was joking with me all the time. Like saying, calling me a joker, actually. You joker. And then like back then I couldn't take a joke. Like, so obviously I'm not a joker anyway, but I couldn't take a joke. And then one day in the association room where you could play pool, make phone calls and stuff, he's like, joker. And I was like, oh, what are you talking about, bruv? Like, stop calling me a joker. And then he just jumped up, was like, what? Just come over to me and just headbutted me. But I got a sharp broken tooth, and he headbutted the tooth. And I dropped to the floor, like my jaw was rattled. I dropped to the floor and I looked up, and then his head was just like pissing out with blood. And I grabbed the pool cue and I started chasing him around the room. And then the screws come in. They took him because he attacked me first, and I never actually got him with a snooker cue. Yeah. Anyway, I went back to my prison cell, started thinking about this guy, and he was in prison for murder and attempted murder. He had thrown two people over a bridge, high off of a bridge, and one of them drowned straight away, and the other person like woke up floating down the Thames. And then I was just like thinking, like when you're locked in a prison cell 23 hours a day, your mind can be a dangerous thing, overthinking. Like, how do you lock off? Yeah. So sitting there in my prison cell, and I'm thinking about this guy 24/7. Like, oh my God, this guy, he's in for murder. He ain't got nothing. He's going to come back, kill me now. Need to be like on my guard. Comes back 2 weeks later. I'm serving up the food. I work on a server. I'm serving up the food, and I'm thinking like I've been thinking about this for 2 weeks. It's like
played on your
mind, overtaken. Like I can't sleep and stuff. This guy's gonna actually kill me. He's actually a killer. It's not no bullshit. He's gonna kill me. The screw said, "Oh, so and so is coming back. It's fine. He was squashy with you. Shake your hand." And then I'm serving up the food. I look around the corner. He just walks around, and he's just staring at me with his eyes. Right. Like, this kid just watching me like this, yeah? And then I'm thinking, like, oh, this is it. Like, anyway, say a day or so later, we shook hands, but I thought, I ain't trusting this guy. Yeah. This is a guy's a killer. And I was, like, sweeping up the landings and stuff, and he was working, like, moving bins and stuff around the unit. So our paths are always crossing. I'm thinking he's going to stab me. And I was hearing stories about how he stabbed someone, this and that. And it basically overtook my life. Where I lost control mentally, I had an obsessive compulsive disorder. Like anything that reminded me of him, it just got me. So my mind started saying stuff to me like, oh my God, if you don't touch that bit of table there 3-4 times, that guy's going to kill you or you're going to die and you're never going to see your family again. So my mind was telling me this and it was like, I was touching something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I was going out on the association room and when people weren't looking, I was going 1, 2, 3, like touching things, 5, doing all this weird
stuff.
Say there was like a black dot on the wall, like in my cell. I was like looking over at the black dot and I started thinking I can hear people talking about me out the window and stuff. And it just like, it was terrorizing me. It was my mind terrorizing myself. And it was like, I keep this guy close, keep him cool. So I'm acting cool with him. But in my mind, I'm convinced he's going to kill me.
How does it feel talking about this? Like from an OCD point of view? I mean, like you did the tap on the table just then.
Yeah.
Does that trigger anything?
No, it triggers a little fear, but I'm just like, I tell myself, bring
you're
it
peace
then.
With it, yeah.
No, I said, bring it then. I don't fear that voice in my head.
Oh, fucking
like,
right.
Like, bring it on. Like, because that's what you got to do. Yeah, like, you've got to overcome your fears.
You've
like,
got to fight your
fears. Yeah, you've got to fight your fears. Face them head on. So this guy, and then I started doing all this number stuff in my head. So his cell number was 217. So even today, say I saw a bus, a local bus called 127, and then it brings back that straight away. And then, but then obviously I just deal with it. I'm not sitting in a prison cell thinking about it 24/7. But then it got to the point where he got moved to a different prison, and it was like, my mind was like, nah, he might have moved, but he's here. His whole vibe and energy's here, right? Yeah. And like,
but you're getting into the mind playing.
Yeah, the mind playing tricks on me. So I'm in my cell, and I've got this cell like clean, like everything. I know where everything goes, like everything's neat and that. The prison officer said, you need to move up onto the 2's landing. He's going to move upstairs, yeah? And then I'm like, oh my God, I've got to move. Like, what if that guy has been in the prison cell? I just wasn't well.
You sit on a needle or something.
Yeah. I was like,
just crazy thoughts.
Crazy thoughts, right? And then I have to move, right? So I'm up in this new prison cell. I'm like cleaning up the prison cell. And then I'm thinking, oh my God, like, has he been in here? It's like, and then finally I calm down in the evening, settling in my new cell. And I'm laying on the bed. And then I'm just like, just sitting there thinking. And I'm looking at the door and then I can see like a faded like name tag on the wall, right? Obviously, where I'm into graffiti, I recognize scratches, tags, fades and stuff. So I'm like, no way is this, And then I get up, go to the door, it's his name, like his surname was here. And then it was like, oh my God, I started having this panic attack, like, oh my God, he's in here, he's going to get me, like, oh, I just lost the plot, right?
Yeah, of course.
Right, get into bed, I'm like, oh my God, like, he's been in this bed. I started sleeping on the floor, a rock hard, freezing cold prison floor.
Because it's logical.
I'm just sleeping on the floor like this,
Any authorities at that point have any compassion of...
I didn't know that they knew something was going on with me, that they were talking in the background. And then the night screw would come round and they'd be like, Rollins, what are you doing on the floor? You're right. And I'm like, oh yeah, the bed's not comfortable, Right. Anyway, then I lost it, right? I was like, I cry for help, I smashed up the TV and I piled all books and clothing up against the door and I just lit it, like set it on fire, and I got the glass on TV. I started cutting out my arm.
Because you wanted out of there.
Yeah, I just need to get out. Like, just didn't know what to do. I was too scared to talk about it. And then the prison screws, the alarm's going off they stick the hose through the little hole in the cell door and they're just like spraying me down like I'm a rat, I'm just drenched. And then they make me strip all of my clothing off. I remember I got wounds and that on my arms as well. My wrists are bleeding.
Is this from your own self?
From self-harming, from smashing the TV. And they're like hosing me down and I'm just like running from one side of the cell to the other and they're like laughing when they're doing it. And all you can see is an eye. That eye will stay with me forever because you can just see an eye and hear a laugh.
Oh, fuck that, bro. Jesus Christ. This is like... This is hard to hear, bro. This is crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have to talk about it to basically overcome my fear of it.
I totally respect that.
Yeah, and then, but then they strip you naked and they put you to the, Rollins, get to the end of your cell now. Put your nose up against the wall, right?
Yeah.
Naked, shivering.
Mm.
Obviously, I've been inhaling smoke and hands on your head. So I've got my hands on my head. And then they're like, I'm going to walk in the cell. I've got a riot shield. I'm going to place the riot shield on your back and you're going to take slow steps and we're going to move backwards together and out the cell. So doing that, we're moving backwards, move backwards. And then step out the cell, step to the left, and I just look out the corner of my eye and they're all the fire brigades there. Like just normal men, normal working people that haven't been around normality for years now.
And you don't see them normally, so it's like...
And they're just seeing me like some maniac, like... That they just see you. You ain't got family. Yeah. You ain't no love or nothing. And they look. And then there's female nurses. Obviously, they're in their full uniform. And I'm just like butt naked, just like a wild animal, can't breathe. And it was just.
And you know, in retrospect, that ain't you.
Yeah, I'm not, yeah.
But I've done this for a reason. Yeah. And my head's gone there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
then
say like a couple of weeks later, I knew about Broadmoor Hospital for the Criminally Insane. Well, I don't even know if you're allowed to say that no more, but that's what it was, a hospital for the criminally insane. I knew about that. The place scared me because I was with another killer in a previous prison. I was reading a book and this guy was in Broadmoor and I'd tell this other killer, you're going to Broadmoor, like winding him up. And say like a year later, I'm in another prison and I get a letter through and there's a little slip and it says, this mail has been thoroughly checked by the security at Broadmoor. And he actually went to Broadmoor. So I knew what Broadmoor was like. And this nurse that I was cool with came over to me and sat me down and was like, look, Justin, they're talking about sending you, getting you sectioned under the Mental Health Act. And I'm like, what does that mean? You could be put in a hospital. All your prison sentence will stop here. You're going to a psychiatric unit. You could be there 6 months. You could be there 10 years. And then they bring you back to your prison sentence. I was like, could they send me Broadmoor? And he was like, yeah, of course they could send you Broadmoor. And he was like, you need to buckle down now and get on with your time and hold it together.
Bro, you have just, I feel so bad for you, locked in the system, bro.
Locked
in the fucking system.
Yeah, but I put myself there, do you know what I'm saying? My actions put myself there. I hold nothing against anyone there. So then it was like, oh my God, right. I'm having this OCD, wash my hands, oh my God, this guy's been in the cell, like don't touch this numbers and all this stuff. But it was like, I ain't going to a psychiatric. I've got about a year left on my sentence, man. I'm going to get my head down. So I started fighting the thoughts in my head. If you don't touch that thing 3 times, you're going to die. And then I'm speaking, fuck off, like saying this, fuck off to myself, yeah? And it was like, you didn't touch that thing over there 5 times earlier on. And it's like, and then I'm about to go up to do it. And then my mind's saying, no, don't do it, fuck off. I'm telling these thoughts, fuck off. Telling these thoughts, fuck off. So many times that they finally just start fading away. But this happened at the same time where I'd lost my job and everything. So now I'm going down to the servery to collect my food. And this prisoner just like froze the yogurt on my tray. It's like, dickhead, like that. And then I'm just like, this is like, basically, if I take this disrespect from this guy, then I'm going to sit in my cell and he's going to be another one of those
thing.
Killers.
Yeah, that's right.
He's going to start eating me away and all of this stuff's going to come. So it's like, I've got to get him.
Yeah.
So I'm shouting out the door. I'm going to get you. And he's like, bring it on. Then he starts dissing my friend that passed away, Bath. Yeah. That's it. So I got my curtain tie, made a little hole in it. I filled up with batteries sock, but it was batteries
and then,
twisted it up. And I went out into the association unit. And he was like looking at me like that, but he had a pool cue in his hand, but I just moved too quickly. I started hitting him with it. And then he like cracked the pool cue around my face. That was it. It got split up. I went to segregation unit. A segregation unit is like basically a concrete bed on the floor with a mattress on it.
Okay.
Really dirty, lonely. Can't hear no other prisoners. And I had just made this decision with myself that I have to fight off this OCD and stuff to do with that killer. Now I'm having to fight it in the worst possible environment now because I'm on my own for 24 hours a day, basically.
Did fighting him at that point cause an upper hand in your head where it was like, it wasn't as bad as the other
guys? Oh, no, I'm talking about fighting the original person in my head. Okay, so I beat that guy in my mind.
Right, gotcha. Okay.
I beat him in my mind, so he's not going to creep with me into this, you know, but I had just started fighting the original guy, the OCD and stuff that had started. I'd be put in segregation unit for 3 weeks for the attack, so that was the hardest place to start fighting the OCD to do with the killer and stuff, but I came out of it without the OCD. So I've always said to myself, if I manage to fight back in that environment, then I can do anything. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I can overcome stuff.
Did it mentally cause a problem with your last year of sentence? Did you have an extension?
That was around a time when they couldn't... The prison system used to be able to put extra days, just give you extra days.
I think
the governor could. And then something came out, and then everyone that had got extra days, it just got wiped off.
I had a couple of mates that were released.
It was that the person that you attacked would have to bring outside charges to get you extra time. But he didn't bring out outside charges, the guy. I got out of that prison sentence. I came out of it. But coming out, I was even more like, I was disturbed. I was locking myself in my bedroom at my mum's house. I was like 20, 21 then. Yeah. And my bedroom was my cell. My mum had a neighbour that was her friend. I remember going downstairs and she was like, oh, this is George, my neighbour. And then I'm looking at him, he's like, my energy, man, my eyes were gone. And I was just like a dark, scary guy. And I looked at him and he was like, he's a threat, he's a screw, he's a prisoner. I get back up to my room and then I couldn't even go past my mum. In my mind, my mum was like a prison officer. And I started getting big like bottles and I was having to like piss in the bottles because I couldn't go downstairs and come out of my cell, which was a bedroom.
Course, yeah.
And they expect you to come out of prison and go and get a job and like fit in with normal people. Do you know what I mean? I just couldn't do that. And then I just thought the easiest way to go is... to go back into crime and just things had changed by then. My WZ had disappeared.
Well, you was the head man, so...
It disappeared. People had kids and moved on. People were working. Other people was up to dodgy things and stuff. And it was just like...
Did you feel like there was a regression there? Did you feel like, oh, man, like, you know, like you could have just held it out in not got, you know, not voluntarily get yourself bagged?
I'm glad that it all fell away. That time just took it away. Do you know what I'm saying?
So it became like a massive...
Yeah, because it hit disaster point anyway. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like
lying in the sand that you weren't there.
Yeah, WZ, one of our guys went away for murder. Another WZ boy was murdered. Another one went away for attempted murder.
Wow.
And then my best friend Joe was found in Malden. In like suspicious circumstances,
found dead.
Yeah, found dead, and so
bro, that could have been any of them, or that could have been you as well.
Yeah, so WZ basically came to a halt for me. Then it was like, what is this? I was this kid that created this character Sevens through graffiti, turned into from a graffiti crew into a street gang. I was somehow pushed to the leader of this, and then all of this stuff happened around me. I felt some sort of responsibility. It was confusing, and then that's when I basically locked it off by going on that prison sentence. I was just lost in that prison sentence, didn't know who I was, didn't know what I was doing.
So you
battle
you coming out, and like you say, the paranoia striking within your family environment, you just felt it was inherent that you just jumped back into a situation which you had more control over.
I didn't have any qualifications, but I had, and that sounds weird, but I had qualifications in the street and in just stealing and robbing and stuff like that. So I was just falling back into that lifestyle. But then it was the eyes of the killer never left me that first time when he had come out of segregation and he walked around the corner and he was just staring at me in my eyes, even to this day. I don't carry that energy anymore where I'm angry and like anyone tests me, I'm gonna kill them, I'm gonna annihilate them so they're not in my head. So I don't really walk down the street and attract someone like that. But say on the odd occasion I walk down the road and I see someone, guy with an attitude watching me, I have a 2 second rule. I look over, 1, 2, clocked it, just look the other way, just keep walking. I don't attract it into my life. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm. But that eyes thing, that was post-traumatic stress, man. I believe the fear of that childminder was always in me, and then it was escalating through my childhood, bullies before the graffiti, and then WK, and then some like a younger DDS writer that would bully me, and then prison, and then that guy with a killer, and that's when it just exploded from like a child, like everything come out. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it become like what it became. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a level. This is like some shit. Like on the therapy side of things, you know, on the plus side of how you've come through, you know, in your career and your work, and because. I saw you at the exhibition. No, the launch, the Harry launch.
All right.
Book launch.
Yeah, yeah.
And I recognised you off the bat as being the guy from the documentary that I checked. Yeah. You know, from the interview on Channel 4 and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know, man. It's like the most positive of energy. So clearly, and it also just chilling here like this. You know, you don't radiate any sort of like background such as that. And I think that's kind of testament to your character. It's clear that, I guess, you know, the tape in your head had been, you know, worn to the thinnest it could go. Yeah. And now it's almost like it's just a new format.
Yeah, it's weird because I got that documentary on YouTube probably come out, say, 9 years ago, and I was talking, I was like laughing, but it was a bit of more of a nervous laugh, and I was swearing constantly, effing this, effing that, effing that. But I basically wrote that book, and I had that ego, street mentality. I was, like, say, 23, 24, I was respected in my community as being like a violent, or I was feared in my community being a violent man. I was respected by like a lot of like, you know, the people, the dodgy, the people that are on stuff. And that's what I craved back then. But then I just started, so I wrote The Lost Boys, and there was an ego side to it. I'm this, I'm that.
Mm.
But that side is just, it's just weak to me. I wanted it to be called Lucky Sevens, I was this lucky character that survived all of that. But then my publisher was like, nah, the way you write and how honest you are, this can be studied in unis and can be, people can learn from this and how a child can go off a path. So I basically wrote that book, and I couldn't spell properly. My punctuation grammar was rubbish, but my narrative and my storytelling was like really good. So that book basically changed my life, and then it showed me like, I can actually help people and being brutally honest and stuff, because people don't come out. I know there's probably people that are going to watch this that have got a secret OCD or a secret mental health. Like if you don't talk about it or face it, man, it can eat you up. I know 5 people that have committed suicide, like a few of them close to me, like my boy, Chez WZ, Jermaine Taylor, MC Jammin' T as well, his name was, he committed suicide. My sister's boyfriend, Jamie Davis, he committed suicide. I know Tracy that I was in prison with, he committed suicide. Loads of young men that I know that have committed suicide. And I think, this can't be everyone, but some of them could be here today if they spoke about what was going on in their mind. Do you know what I'm saying?
More than that, this information, this passing of understanding and communicating these
so that's what I say. People say, how can someone commit suicide? How can, if you like, for example, what I said, and I'm in my cell and my mind's saying all this stuff to me, and sometimes you're just not in control of your mind, isn't it? So like I thought about suicide and stuff, but just being scared to die, or being scared to die in prison and never seeing like the road again is what stopped me. But just like What have I got to fear, man? What have I got to fear? Fear's like an illusion.
Yeah. It's an illusion, bro.
On the other side of fear is happiness. This is what I tell myself. On the other side of fear is happiness, yeah? Mm. So if you don't face it, then you're always going to hold yourself back. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's incredible you come through, man. And it's like that whole idea. I think family plays a part in it as well. You know, as you grow up, you kind of, you know, you've got to pass information down and shit.
Love for my kids and my wife. It's like there's nothing that's my crew, that's my gang. Do you know what I mean?
I like that.
I'm really strict in my ways. Like I don't drink. I don't like smoke. I don't take drugs or anything. Like, but I know I'm not a person that can just. Well, I have a one cider every now and again. Yeah. But I can't have more than that, or I can't smoke weed or do drugs. I'm not one of them people that can just do it once. It would turn me. I fear that sevens will come into my head, that crazy guy. So I'm really strict to everything, and you've got to be strict. Sometimes I think you have to be disciplined. Sometimes I feel like my life was wild, on the railways, doing crime, doing crazy shit, adrenaline buzz. Mm. And then all of a sudden, I'm sitting in a house. And I've got the responsibility of being a dad and a husband. And oh my God, I've got these kids I've got to bring up. And I'm so passionate about how you bring your kids up. Because I look at my childhood where there weren't a lot of love and stuff. And look where I went down. Mm. Do you know what I'm saying? So I'm so passionate and strict of it. And then sometimes sitting in my house and I'm like, I'm bored and I'm a bit agitated and that. Because my past was just wild and a big adventure. But then I just looked at my kids and my wife and that, and then it's like, nah, this is it here. I go and do my graph as my little therapy when I'm feeling a bit like...
It's like being off. A soldier, yeah, bro. Yeah. It's like there's that mental thing of coming off of being out on... You know, on soldier duties, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's that. I've heard that, the post-traumatic stress soldier side, but... obviously I've seen a lot of dark stuff and that on the streets and stuff, but the soldiers, what they're seeing in different countries and that is completely different level post-traumatic stress than us. Like no human just see another human blown to bits and stuff like that. Do you know what I'm saying? So on a level, there's different levels of post-traumatic stress. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Wow. What an amazing journey thus far. What an amazing fucking gimme.
Yeah, respect,
top boy,
man.
Top cool boy. Man. What's the plans then? So you're going to turn this thing into a movie?
Yeah, so...
Turning the book into something?
Yeah, I can't really say the director's name and stuff because the way that the film industry works, not always, you could have a production company comes in bang, I'm buying that book, everything's just rolls. They've got their script writer, director, everything. But another way it comes up, director picks up my book, buys the film option, then he's got the links in the industry, producer, production company, script writer. So all of that's going on in the background, the script and got the director. Got a good few production companies lined up waiting for the script, which they're going to be getting a script soon. And then obviously the production company has the links for the funding for the film. And people don't really know about British films, but most British films, like crime films, are called low budget. It doesn't mean low quality, but they're classed as low budget because a British film could be a low budget British film could be like $1 million to say 8 million or something. And then if you think of another film like Star Wars or something, that's like 260 million. That's why it's classed as a low budget movie. Yeah. So the production company will go out and search that funds. For the film, and then obviously I get my cut. But I've got family, obviously kids and stuff, so that motivates me money wise. But it's all about just getting the story out there. A group of lost boys coming together, trying to create a family, and the family just spirals completely out of control. There's the graffiti side. There was some dark other stuff bang in the middle of it, like the House of Horrors, which is in the book. That's never been shown on British film. That's always been my goal. Like, if money comes from it as well, that's a bonus for my kids. But it's always...
I've always been passionate about the documentation of history.
Yeah. I want the graph side. That's never been shown in a British sort of street crime sort of
It hasn't, thing. Has it?
Yeah, no, it's never been shown. So I've always visioned it, and I always knew I'd make it happen. So, and also, The Lost Boys is studied in... Birmingham City University in criminology.
Ooh,
So 500 students each year, first year criminology students, have to study the Lost Boys. Or I say the Lost Boys because it's me and my friends, yeah, like Bath, Letters, and Chez. But they have to basically study my life. But where I'm not on the whole ego thing, and it was about me and my friends, I say they're studying Lost Boys, but they have to write an essay on why did Justin Rollins, was it Nurture or Nature? But I always say it's
I have these questions, is crazy.
I always say they're studying Lost Boys. I'm like, they're studying my life. But they are, but it's always, for me, it's the Lost Boys. Life,
For that to actually feed back in a more constructive, it's constant analysis, bro. You're constantly getting questioned and you're always getting answers. So amazing.
And it's going into Coventry Uni this year as well. Wow. 250 second year criminology students. And it's in Aberdeen Uni in Scotland as well. That's optional. So say the first year students can choose from 5 books and one of them's The Lost Boys. So
that's got to be The Lost Boys, surely. Wow. Well, it's been a fucking pleasure, bro.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Thanks so much for being honest and passing through and just telling your story. It's fucking incredible. Cool, man. Top dog, you know what I mean?
Thanks, mate.
Justin Rollins inside the place, man. 706, all right? Hold tight. Once again, big shout out to everybody following us and subscribing, downloading, liking, sharing, telling a friend to tell a friend. Do not sleep, I repeat. Do not sleep on my repeat. Killer Keller Podcast. Thanks for having us.